Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG pod overflow, the Cinephobe cold opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
Said the OG pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays, you're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're going to get Amin in those, so you got to listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like, because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora, he's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/countthedings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hey, Pack Your Knives listeners, this is Tom here. I just wanted to let you know that Pack Your Knives is part of the Count the Dings network. We've got a whole buffet of great selections for you. You see what I did there. If you are a sucker for terrible movies, go laugh with us on the Cinephobe podcast. If you're deep into the Black Lives Matter movement, can't recommend highly enough listening to Bomb. That's Black Opinions Matter Mondays, B-O-M-M podcast. I'm on the Dad Pod, which is on the Count the Dings feed. And also go check out the Friday Mailbag, which is also a Count the Dings podcast. Lastly, if you want to support the network, we have a Patreon set up at patreon.com/countthedings. All right, now with that out of the way, it is time for the Pack Your Knives season finale recap.
Tom, was Top Chef season 17 All-Stars as starry as you hoped it would be?
Oh, yes. And especially with the surprise guest of the carne guy and a teary-eyed carne guy. This was as star-studded as I could have ever dreamed of.
This is Pack Your Knives. I'm Kevin Arnovitz.
And I'm Tom Haverstroh.
Tom, season 17 in the books. An epic finale, lots of crying, lots of laughing, lots of storytelling, lots of food, lots of Italians. Fantastic.
It was upsetting on one level, Kevin. I was totally wrong, totally off on my Zapruder guess, my analysis of those "You are a top chef" Padma announcements was a little off base. I think Eric, your partner, had it right, which is that it was Melissa all along, and Melissa deserved to win this season. She was unflappable. I don't really understand how we got someone with 7 wins, including the finale, 7 wins in the All-Star season, Kevin. Like, when you were going into this, did you expect to see someone just separate themselves so much as Melissa did?
No, I mean, I think the depth of the field and the talent in the field suggested parity.
suggested that, hey, you know, there are 9 or 10 chefs capable of just blowing an elimination challenge out of the park, or for that matter, a quick fire on any given week, which only lends credence to the idea that we're just going to see it's going to be anybody's ball game. And when I look at the last 4 weeks, an absolutely epic run, and later we'll go do the final report card and box score. It is not a pretty sight from an equitability standpoint, your team versus my team. But when you look at Melissa's season, it is one of the most dominant in the history. I believe that someone say on the show that she recorded more wins than any other contestant in the history of Top Chef.
Yes, I believe that's what they have. And I think that's true, maybe. But Paul
Key, we need to check that with with Lynn, right?
Well, yeah, but I just looked up before the show, Kevin, did my own research. Paul Key got 9 wins, including the finale, in his season.
Does that include Quickfire?
It doesn't include Quickfire, so that might be folding in the Quickfire stuff. But then if you consider the phrasing of the most wins in Top Chef history, do you think they might be including just both of those seasons that she – like Melissa and
– Maybe that's it. Maybe that's it.
So she won 2 episodes in that season, 2 elimination challenges. She won 7 elimination challenges in this year, including the finale, which is 9. So I think probably if you do some quick fire math, maybe that puts Melissa over the top. But certainly, I think we can all agree, Kevin, that Paul Key had the single greatest performance of any individual season up until this point. But when you consider the fact that Melissa did what she did, essentially playing in an all-star game where she just dominated with 7 wins, with the level of competition as high as it was, where you had, you know, Brian Voltaggio, Gregory Gaudette, Kevin Gillespie, all who probably should have won any average season on their own. She mowed him down, 4 wins in the last 4 episodes. And you know what? Going into the final judges table, there was no doubt in my mind that this was Melissa's to win. I didn't think it was particularly close with Brian and Steph. Maybe they won a couple dishes here and there, but Melissa did not falter on anything. And I just think, I think it's time to say it, Kevin, the greatest Top Chef contestant of all time, Melissa King.
I would agree, and that's not recency bias. And you also make a very good point about strength of schedule, that she's doing this week in and week out against this kind of competition. I'm looking forward to kind of walking through sort of the 4 quarters, if you will, because it's always fun to kind of when you get to an elimination and you know essentially it's almost kind of an ice skating gymnastics quality scoring where you just kind of need to look event by event and see what's going on. It was a really interesting night because I think it wasn't until kind of late in the third, if you will, that we sort of saw Melissa take over. I really like this episode. I thought it was a great illustration of why this show is as successful as it is. I love that there was a really dominant theme, and the theme was expressed in a lot of different ways by 3 different chefs, and that is that food is a medium of self-expression. It sounds schmaltzy to say that food is art, but I think for folks who don't – not everybody, I think, appreciates that food is not just this substance that we live on and you need. And, you know, I think a lot of people eat to live far fewer live to eat. And I think if you do live to eat, I think you realize, you know, if you sit at enough tables, that food is an expression of identity. It is, as they say, it's a way to tell a story. What I love about Top Chef is by the time you get to the finale, like, you know each chef's identity. What made the finale cool was watching Voltaggio, for instance, you know, as Gail, I think, appropriately said, kind of one of the great technicians the show has ever featured. In the Top Chef contestants, sort of kind of fuse that technical prowess with the heart and soul that he alleged not to have presented in the previous week, right? Like, we saw the great culmination of Melissa's Chinese-Italian fusion, which she essentially been honing for the last 4 weeks, and even prior to getting to Tuscany, just sort of how can I introduce, you know, Chinese flavor, Chinese elements, Chinese technique into as many dishes as possible, you know, without it being gimmicky. And that's always brilliance.
Did you catch that where she kind of said that, like, fusion is sort of a derogatory term in cuisine? And I guess I didn't quite I didn't quite realize that until she said it, where like if I go into a restaurant and I see Chinese Italian fusion, I'm probably going to be like, "Oh, what? I don't know
No, she's right. I mean, largely she's right because there's a lot of shitty fusion food. I mean, I don't need another sushi burrito. I don't need pizza that has like pepper jack cheese and hey, it's a taco. No, it's a pizza. Like, you know, I mean, there's just a lot of really shitty fusion food.
Yeah.
I mean, some of it is organic. I mean, I think one of the beauties of kind of Peruvian food is just the presence of the Japanese community in that part of South America. So I think you get some authentically rendered fusion food. But she's right. There's a lot of shitty fusion food that's been presented in the last 20 years, sort of trying to capitalize, you know, on the ascent of multiculturalism or just, hey, isn't this fun? And by the way, there's some good. I mean, I think Koji here in Los Angeles, sort of the Korean barbecue taco, was a stroke of genius, and accessible and kind of organic in its emergence. But she's right. And then finally, Stephanie, you know, she's never had a distinct style. I think that we could say her food is homey. It's just damn good. But I think for her, the storytelling was about her emergence. I mean, she's somebody who's suffered great trauma personally. Clearly, food is how she's, you know, everybody has their way out of that. And for her, the show and cooking in general has been that. So for her, yeah, it wasn't about, hey, translating my technicality into elegance or the culmination of this sort of style I'm fashioning. For her, it was a true expression of identity and in some ways, reconciliation. Mm-hmm. So I just love that about this episode. I thought, we were overcome with emotion watching it. I mean, I think you get to live with these chefs for 14 weeks, even as a viewer. And I just thought it was a perfect distillation of why people love this show.
I couldn't agree more. And I think when I found myself a little overly emotional in the moment when, I guess this happens every season, but when Padma, Tom, and Gail are cooking for them. And I don't know. That's like my favorite part of this series is when the three chefs cook for the contestants at the end, their like last supper before they do their cook. I love that, Kevin. I don't know what it is. It's almost like family. It's almost like what other show does that? It's not like at the end of the NBA season, like Adam Silver like plays one-on-one with all the guys, right?
God.
Like imagine that. Like David Stern, like, you made it this far. Let's go play one-on-one, fellas. And then you would – like that doesn't happen. But on this show, it just feels so authentic. It feels like – I'm so impressed by the fact that this show has lasted as long as it has. And if you haven't listened yet to Tom Colicchio's interview with us, it was really fun to talk to him. But the idea is that the judges are not gimmicky. They're right there with them in terms of the prowess, the technique, the skill of being a cook. Like Gail and Padma and Tom cooking for them and them sitting down, just kind of a release of emotions and stress. And I just love that. It really, I don't know why this particular season or this particular moment, but again, with all the tears and stuff that we witnessed on the show, I love that moment when they sit down for their last meal.
Well, it projects a lot of warmth, I think largely because it's an acknowledgement from the host and the judges that, look, yeah, these chefs are talented and it's fun to be on a show, but they're basically asked to be lab rats for a couple of months. They're constantly under a microscope. They are being judged. And as I say, look, to the extent that food is a medium of self-expression, like they're being judged. I mean, like Brian Voltaggio had to get up there the previous couple of days prior to this dinner and be told by the most famous chefs in a country that's regarded as sort of a food haven, that like the guy has no heart and soul. So I think it's sort of a acknowledgement that you are kind of put through the ringer. It's stressful and you're just constantly on the go. I mean, you can see how exhausted, you know, Karen looked after her kind of big day and
yeah,
comeback and everything else. And it's just an acknowledgement that, you know, also you've been feeding these motherfuckers for 14 weeks, right? Like, you know, at least, you know, they return the favor and it's really nice. It's also kind of fun even from a contextual standpoint for us. Like it's kind of cool to watch Tom Colicchio cook. I've enjoyed those, those little shorts. And you know, just watching Padma in the kitchen is also fun. So,
hey,
also Kale's tart look really good.
Yeah. Cooper Moorhead, our friend Cooper, texted me. He said, please, can I just have Gail come over and make me that that tart dish? He was all about that. Me too. I think – can we talk about the draft?
Oh, yeah, the pick your sous chef. That's kind of our first – let's get into it. Let's get into the episode. We'll talk more about the big themes. But pick your sous chef. Stephanie gets first choice. And with the first choice in the sous chef finale draft, Stephanie – Smar selects Brian Mullarkey of San Diego, California. I think it's a really good choice. I'm going to hear your thoughts, though.
Oh, my. What a perfect sous chef. Throughout this episode, yeah. I just talk about 180s on a character. Is he like the best sous chef of any of these contestants? Because he was loving. He was supportive. He was enthusiastic, just overly positive. And you could tell that Steph was just like in the zone. And you never felt like maybe Leanne was kind of overly suggestive and overly, you know, stepping on Melissa's toes. I didn't really feel that with Brian Mullarkey, which, you know, considering he has issues with editing, I thought maybe he'd be all over Stephanie with some of her choices. But he was so, so good, and it really validated her pick as the number one pick.
No, and I think as a sous chef, a lot of his vulnerabilities are mitigated, right? Like, he's not going to – like, you're choosing what's going in the dish. Like, he just has responsibilities to execute from a support standpoint. So, it's perfect. And he is kind of a positive guy. He is imbued with optimism. You could see throughout the cook – that Stephanie, you know, even when she learned that you know, Tom was familiar with their dish, it kind of freaked her out for a second. I mean, Mullarkey is this reservoir of positivity, as long as you don't, like, fuck with his setup at a summer camp. You know, like, other than that, he's, you know. Voltaggio takes Kevin. No surprise there. Yeah. These two guys are close. And Kevin, I think, is also just a good partner. It was funny. Melissa and he worked so well together as a tandem earlier in the season. I can't remember right offhand which challenge it was that they won and just blew out of the park. But Voltaggio gets Kevin and Melissa and Leanne. We had a real kick at watching Leanne at the market with that was the laugh track of our episode last night. Watching it was just need some candy. Like, the other thing is, like, is there anything about Melissa's cooking that would suggest she would ever use candied walnuts on anything?
I missed that. Did she really suggest candied walnuts?
It was like, do you need some chives? Do you need some this? Do you need some that? Do you need that? You know, it was just, it was adorable, but it was just like, do you need some candied walnuts? And it was just like, is there anybody less likely to cook with candied walnuts than Melissa King? Like, leave her alone.
I know. It was so, I have it in my notes. Leanne passive aggressively asking, do you want blank or anything? Oh, just like, no, like, poor Melissa, just this is her last cook, her four-course meal that she's been thinking about for weeks and weeks and weeks. And Leanne is just – I know she's trying to be helpful. But first of all, let's talk about this real quick. Leanne was there because – or Leanne was one of the candidates to be chosen because Gregory Gaudette was out with a back injury.
Yes.
And I had presumed that he had flown home, where they sent him home with like, hey, man – go home. Don't worry about it. Or at least just hang back. We're not going to include you anymore. Don't worry about your responsibilities on the show. Then he shows up later. So I'm curious to hear, if we ever hear what happened there. But Leanne shows up and, you know, we know that Leanne has been a really big part of Top Chef from a production standpoint. She's been the head of culinary for the show. And so I'd imagine she was there as kind of a staffer or a kind of production team and then stepped up. And I mean, Melissa, we talk about strength of schedule. Melissa gets, in my opinion, of the three, the least desirable of the three sous chefs. And she still plows the competition.
Yeah. Let's get into the episode because four courses, really interesting in the sense that it's a broad canvas. You can do what you like. I loved how Padma presented it. No twists. You just do your thing. And in some ways, I find that to be the most representative meal. You really get to sense of who these people are. They don't have to negotiate with the terms. They don't have to conform to certain parameters. They can just do their thing. I do think each was cognizant of the setting, and I love that. That was the one thing I appreciated, because I think there is a question, okay, do I just go and cook my food, or do I need to be mindful
yep.
of whom I'm cooking for, where I am cooking, and also, I mean, to some extent, what produce is going to be available. It was lovely to see. I didn't even realize there were sort of persimmons that grow in Italy because I'm used to the, you know, to the fuyus and the hachias out here. Like, that's what we get in Southern California. So it was like, what is this massive beach ball of a persimmon? It's like, what the hell is that? So,
And the porcini mushrooms that are basically catcher's mitts.
The porcini mushrooms. Wow. And we'll talk about those. First course, you know, so this is essentially what we'll call an appetizer because all the chefs kind of chose as the primi to do, not the primi, but first, to do the pasta course as the second course. So this is sort of your primi. This is the appetizer. Melissa kind of getting off on her theme to do char siu grilled octopus. I mean, that char siu, that is sort of like if you ever go to a traditional, like, you know, like the to-go Chinese barbecue places where you walk in, you can order pork or duck by the pound, and they chop it up with that massive-ass cleaver, and he pours a little bit of the gravy on top. Like that, if I'm correct, is sort of that sweet barbecue sauce. And so she does that. And by the way, I think by all accounts, Tom finishes third after one quarter. Am I correct?
I have it scored here, Stephanie, Brian, Melissa.
Right. I have Voltaggio and Stephanie neck and neck here. Yep. I think,
but Melissa definitely third on this one.
Right. I mean, because she, Tom's comment was, it was very sweet. It needed some acid. And that's just sort of the nature of the sauce. Voltaggio, I just love what Voltaggio did, you know, because it's like beets are fun. They're so meaty. They're so substantial. We've seen so many fun things with beets. If you remember Carrie's beet gummies that just vaulted her to the next round?
Yep.
Back in, I think, the Colorado season. And, you know, he takes, you know, tonnato is just like one of the classic kind of sauces. I mean, usually tuna-based with just that kind of mayonnaise-iness. And yet he turns it into this beautiful thing with all those, you know, all those umami notes with the bonito and everything else. And then Stephanie has the sentimental favorite, which he also just nails from a technical standpoint, Tom.
Kevin, I could eat 1,000 of those, with the shrimp katafi things.
Yeah.
Oh my, that looks so good with the little crispy pasta wrapped around and encased in that with the shrimp underneath. And I was really worried about the idea of frying it. And like Tom, I was like, oh, I don't know. That's going to be a tough cook for Stephanie. But I thought that was so cool visually. I've never seen anything like that before. So when she pulled that out, I was just like, I want 1,000 of those.
Right. And it's interesting because you look at the three dishes, they're all put in front of them at the same time. You know, hers is the only one really with a crunch. Hers has by far the most textural complexity. And I think it just kind of wowed the chefs. And also when you hear the story, it makes total sense. Because at first I was like, is this a little basic? I mean, I know you're dressing it up with a katafi, but at the end of the day, it's just kind of shrimp and a tangerine, you know? And it turns out, no. I mean, this is sort of an interpretation of that delicious coconut fried shrimp we've all eaten at one time or another, which for her was a callback to her late brother and something she constantly cooked for him that he loved. And so not only was she able to elevate the dish from a storytelling standpoint, but she offers a texture that none of the other chefs are doing. And, you know, after one quarter, I looked over at my viewing partner, who you know, and I was just like, let me tell you something. Because, like, I'm under the impression that Stephanie she has mastered pasta. She has won the most recent dessert challenge. As far as I'm concerned, like, this is anybody's game. I mean, the fact that Melissa enters the kitchen after round one, essentially unbeknownst to them, in third place is amazing.
Yeah. And it wasn't that... It wasn't that that Melissa really screwed up or had a bad dish. It was just, oh man, she's gonna have to come back from this with perfection, like you said. Like this is not going to be easy for Melissa.
So the second course, and it's even hard to totally handicap this. This was a masterclass in pasta making. You know, Melissa comes with her squash enchilada with the Szechuan chili oil. I love nothing more than crispy chicken skin or crispy salmon skin. I love crispy skin as an additive to anything. And then she also has shiso in there. I forget which judge said it. What was great about it is one of those dishes, and we've all had dishes like this, Tom, where it's like, you know, there are a couple different things going on, and whichever bite you get, if you get the bite that's, you know, it's a crispy chicken skin, you're happy. If you get a bite that has the shiso note, you're happy. Mm-hmm. So she nails that. Stephanie has this Taleggio Cappelletti that with Leggio cheese and a chicken brodo that I think one of the judges says is the most complex and elegant or you know, kind of refined dish on the table. So just – and also kind of a surprise. You know, her cooking is – Tom, is very often homey. It's cozy. I wouldn't say rustic, but this was – I mean, it was gorgeous.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how you scored this. I think I got Brian, Steph, and Melissa on this one is how I graded it out.
Yeah, I have Voltaggio winning, and I'm going to talk about his thing in a second because to me it was the biggest badass dish of the night in many respects.
Yeah.
And let's talk about that for a second. So Voltaggio, to bring listeners up to date, just to remind, you know, Voltaggio is a modern technical cooking. They're you know, he's doing the cardamom soil for dessert. He's got foams and aerated cheeses, and he is somebody who likes to mess and fool around to a beautiful effect with kind of the form of food itself. And didn't go so well in sort of Tuscany, you know, kind of – it was an away game. I mean, he has been playing away games for the last 3 weeks, Tom. And they dinged him for it. They referred to him as having no soul and no heart. And so he says – you know what he says? And I love Brian Voltaggio for this. Fuck you. You want a fucking lasagna? I'll give you a goddamn lasagna. But I'm going to do it my way. It is going to conform to your specifications. But damn if I'm not going to leave a little bit of a signature on this. And he just does it, Tom. And by every account, he made one of the great lasagnas of all time.
Yeah, it was such a good dish and just a real punchback. You know, he got knocked down to the floor. He gets back up and he just lands a haymaker on the judges with this one. Not overly saucy. It was very pasta forward, I would say. And the technical side of this, he didn't betray that at all with this dish. No. Just because he wanted to go a little bit more traditional with the type of food. I think he beat himself up over it being like, did I just fucking serve lasagna on my last dish? My last cook for the chefs. And, you know, sometimes on this show we beat up the contestants for overthinking things or overcompensating or just overcorrecting for themselves for their prior mistake. I was a little nervous, to be honest, that he was going to overcorrect here and they'd look at this and say, really, lasagna? But sometimes you just nail that sweet spot, and Brian did that absolutely here.
Hello, listener. Guess who's back? It's me, Anthony Mays, your favorite butcher turned podcast producer, and I'm here to talk to you about ButcherBox. ButcherBox is the most convenient way to get high quality meat and seafood that you can trust delivered straight to your doorstep, free shipping, vacuum sealed packaging. It's ready to go right then. It's ready to pop in the freezer. You get exclusive member deals and a variety of high quality cuts at an amazing value. Going to the grocery store can be a huge pain. You're usually in a rush at an inconvenient time. You're waiting in line at the meat counter. You're taking a number. Maybe this place doesn't have a number. You're jostling with fellow customers. You're trying to get that ribeye that you want or that nice piece of salmon. Maybe the butcher that you're dealing with has a bad attitude or something. I don't know. That was never me, I promise. But maybe it happens. ButcherBox takes all of that out of the picture. You are always prepared with meat and seafood in the freezer, and you're not going to find quality for this price anywhere else other than ButcherBox. So sign up at butcherbox.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S, and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional $20 off. You can choose salmon, chicken breasts, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/dings and use code DINGS, D-I-N-G-S, to choose your free for a year offer, plus get $20 off your first order. Hello, listener. I'm sure you don't need me to tell you that we at Cinephobe love our pets. Zach and Boogie are inseparable. I've got two cats and a dog, and Amin is giving his best ass on performance to convince dog owners that he loves their pet.
Hey, little, hey, boy, how you doing? And Noodles is like,
ah, whatever. Which is why today's episode is sponsored by the ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program. For many pet parents, summer is all about making travel plans like adventuring through the national parks, visiting pet-friendly beaches, or road tripping across the country. Wherever your journeys take you and your furry friend, you can help protect them along the way with a plan from ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are, because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
Yeah. And again, as you said, it wasn't a sloppy lasagna kind of, it was truly the Voltaggio version as presented as Voltaggio by Voltaggio, right, of a lasagna, that wild boar, bolognese, which, you know, wild boar kind of being an essential in Tuscany. I was just really excited for him because I love to see things come full circle. And he was kicked around last week in the worst possible way. Again, to the extent that food is a medium of self-expression, he was basically told you express yourself in a shitty way. And like, I was indignant for him and I was thrilled to see. And I don't even say redeem himself. I don't think he had anything to redeem himself for, but sometimes in the life your bosses want something that is not your preferred mode and you just have to do it. And he did it. And he did it without betraying himself or his instincts. So yeah, I scored it as Voltaggio 1 just because I think for the backstory and what he was able to do. And then like, neck and neck. Yeah. I mean, I don't think there was do you feel like in course 2, there was a measurable or substantial gap between, right? So we're essentially coming out of halftime here, Tom, with, I mean, it's anybody's game. I mean, you could argue like Melissa finished third in the first course, they're kind of tied. I don't think anybody has a claim until we get to the entrees.
Man, the squat. So it's amazing that Mel watched Tom grill the squab. And I got a little nervous when she was going out on the deck to grill her squab, because you never really know what to do. You know, we saw Karen in the Olympics episode. She didn't really have a great grill to utilize. And I think there's a lot of variance there. There's a lot of variability with a grill for whatever reason in my head. And so she does the squab. And I mean, even wowing people who don't even like squab. I think Nilu was just like, I don't like squab, and you just made me a convert. And I think that's one of those things where when you see Melissa just turn around and do a dish that she's done this before. And even, you know what, now that I think about it, she did it again with her dessert. She is so calm when she needs to pivot. You never really feel that Melissa is working at a disadvantage, Kevin. You really don't. And for this moment, she's like, you know what? I'm not gonna pan sear the squab, or I'm gonna grill it, or whatever it is. She doesn't scramble. This is just, she's so confident and so calm that even when she's pivoting away from a dish, you get the sense that the original dish that she was pivoting away from would still be awesome. And that's just how good she is.
Well, so I would take issue with one thing, and I want to get back to the grill in a second. I actually feel like, at least from the editing, that Melissa wasn't as in control in the first half of this show as she normally is. Like, it's almost as if she took on some of Leanne's freneticness. Like, we're used to seeing her, like, and you remember that pasta course at the end, the clock's ticking down, and she's just like tossing stuff on the, you know, it wasn't, you know,
yeah,
like I felt like in the, you know, the dessert wasn't coming around. It ate dry the next morning. They had to kind of go back to square one on that. Like, I felt like, absolutely, you're absolutely right. I mean, once she got in gear around course 3, but I felt like in the first half of the show, she was a little less in control than normal, which is saying a lot. And yet she still kind of played to a tie. I went further than you. I'm yelling at the TV. Are you fucking kidding me? Melissa,
You're going to put the greatest season in Top Chef history by an individual chef on the line and just hope and fucking pray that a grill isn't going to be weird. Grills are fickle, particularly grills you do not know.
Yeah.
Like, there's weather out there. You don't know what that grill is capable of doing. You don't know the level. And she even says, hey, it was a lower flame. We kind of got lucky. Well, good for you. I am shocked, and I cannot wait to ask her. Listeners, we are scheduled to visit with the finalists Monday. Let's hope it goes off as scheduled. And yeah. I cannot wait to ask Melissa King. I just want to, like, she is such, she calls herself a control freak, and control freaks of the world unite. I am one of you. I am just floored, Tom.
Yes.
Floored that she did something as whimsical as, oh, it was kind of fun when Tom grilled it last night. And like, grilling also can dry shit out. Like, it's not, like, to me, it was a risk I was shocked to see incurred. And the fact that she not only pulled it off, and everything about that dish, Tom, I am a huge persimmon fan. I cook with them. I can't wait for the first persimmons of fall. I put them in every salad. I make a little compote out of it. It's my favorite thing. And then she does the porcinis, which, as she said, is sort of the runner-up to truffles in sort of a Italian cooking. She confies the caps, and you know, one of the judges who I loved, I don't know who the name it was, he was just like, you know, kind of had a foie gras quality to it.
Marcus Samuelson, yeah.
Boy, that guy's fucking cool. We got to get him on the show, Tom. Yeah. I want to talk to that guy. That guy has some energy I want to get with. And then fermented black bean sauce, so she kind of keeps it in the Chinese influence on a dish that is otherwise universal. It looked gorgeous. It frankly looked another case where, you know, aesthetically, Tom, Melissa's much closer to Voltaggio than she would be to, say, Stephanie or even Gregory. Her stuff is elegant and sort of modern, but she did kind of the big plate special, Italian family style. I mean, it kind of looked like that. I mean, obviously, there were portions on each plate, but the fact that she was able to kind of give it just enough, knowing the setting and knowing, hey, this doesn't look to need to be the most, you know, we're not eating at Ink here. Like, we're eating in an Italian countryside situation.
Yeah, this one, I want to say that Melissa, it wasn't that she had a bad first half, but it was certainly she was coming from behind. And with this dish, I mean, I don't eat squab very often. And like she said, it's kind of like a cousin of quail. And I've eaten quail a bunch, but I've never really had squab enough to know, hey, when she was doing squab, I was like, ooh, I can't wait to eat that. But this particular dish, I was just – I mean, the porcini mushroom that had a consistency, or at least it tasted kind of like foie gras. I mean, this might have been my favorite dish of the night.
Yeah, and it's let's call it what it is, Tom. This is the dish that won her the season.
Yeah,
this was the homer in the bottom of the eighth. I mean, or bottom of the set, whatever it was. Like, this was the master stroke that won her the season. As you said, it was essentially a push coming in. She might have even been slightly behind, given sort of the Voltaggio moment of grace and the Stephanie moment of grace in the first course. And this is the dish that won it, largely, by the way, because unfortunately the other chefs, you know, just were a little off on this one. Less Voltaggio than Stephanie. I want to talk about Stephanie for a second. I was a little concerned when she said milk braised veal breast. I mean, veal is lean. It is a lean cut. That means it doesn't produce the kind of fat you would want. That ultimately, what is braising, if not, yeah, you have a braising liquid, but it's a meat that, think about those fatty short ribs, like braised short rib. Like, yep. you gotta soak in your own fat, right? Yep. Like, it bathes in its own juices. There ain't a lot of juice with a veal breast. It's a lean, lean cut. And when I heard that, I was just really nervous. And then, you know, Malarkey, if we have to fault Malarkey for one thing, and I don't even think he can do this because he's a generally classy guy. You know, someone needed to take Stephanie aside and said, I don't know about this.
I let Stephanie do her thing.
And again, I'm not saying he wouldn't do it, but like, I wonder if he could go back in time. And I'm not putting this on Malarkey, by the way. I'm saying if there was a little birdie who could have whispered in Stephanie's ear, this is too lean of a cut to get this accomplished.
So what would you have done if you were Malarkey? Is it suggesting a different cooking style? Like instead,
I would just. I think it's. By the way, if you, I think if we were to Google milk braised, and I will Google milk braised, I would guess you would have far more results for pork than veal.
Mm-hmm.
Here we go. So okay. I just did milk braised. Top three recipes. Bon appetit. Milk braised pork. Number two is Food and Wines. Pork braised in milk. Number three is Epicurious. Milk braised pork with lemon and sage.
There we go.
I am going down the page. I do not see veal. There is a reason you do not see veal. Veal is too lean for this preparation. I hate to pile on. I love Stephanie. By the way, this has become a Stephanie house. And I mean, there might as well. This is like if Stephanie were the Packers, we are in central Wisconsin right now. Like this house has been a Stephanie house for the last 4 weeks. I have a partner who was crying on the couch, Tom Haberstroh, when Stephanie was doing her thing. We love Stephanie in this house. She's already won my Stuck in an Elevator contest. I hope she gets fan favorite, and she's freaking hilarious and humble and all the qualities I want in a person. However, you can't do veal in a milk braise. Just don't. That needed to be a pork loin. It needed to be a pork shoulder. I think she could have potentially won the season, Tom, if you swap out the veal for a pork loin or a shoulder.
And Malarkey knew it. Malarkey knew it. To his credit, he knew, and he was like, we just got to cover this thing with sauce, baby. Like, we got it. Like, it's too dry. We're just going to smother it with sauce. But at that point, I think Steph knew that. I have it written here. Was that by Steph. Like, that was it. That was the critical mistake where you can't come back from that, especially with everyone else performing at such a high level. Yep. That was Steph Curry tossing the ball behind his back out of bounds to Klay Thompson.
And poor Voltaggio. He makes a cacciuco, which I don't know the difference. I'm going to have to ask the difference between Cioppini and cacciuco.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Tuscan fish
question.
Stew.
Had the same
question. Yeah, look kind of the same. Maybe it's just one variation. Monkfish, octopus, squid ink, focaccia, which look great. One little technical error, I think, and I didn't quite understand the butter and the comment with regard to the focaccia. And then Tom attests that his monkfish wasn't perfectly cooked. So, and again, I think he's up in a situation where every once in a while you come up against a chef who just – Melissa had one of the dishes of the year and the dish of the season. So Voltaggio I had scored as a second. To me, this was the easiest – course to score.
Yep.
I'm sure for you as well.
Melissa, Brian, and Steph. So that's the first one that we have with Melissa winning in this competition. And I think when you saw Brian Voltaggio mention that he was going to do that dish for Tom, and he said, I do that every Christmas Eve with that look of like, you better fucking nail this. Man, that was going to be a tough thing. So I had the same question about what the difference between the Cioppino and his dish, but going into the dessert, Kevin, I have Brian Voltaggio with one win, two middles, and Stephanie with a win, a middle, and a third. I have Melissa with a win and then two bottoms. So really, Kevin, the only
margin.
Right. It's not fair to say, you know, raw numbers here, because just the order of it, it doesn't express it. But bottom line is, this is close as hell going into the fourth.
I mean, I'll just be honest. I feel like because the first two courses, however you order them, there just wasn't much daylight between. Two, I really do think that I think that third course should be weighted greater.
It is.
No disrespect to the pasta or the appetizer, but this is the main deal. I mean, when you go for a four-course meal, it's the entree that you really need to sing. And given the disparity between her and the other two, you know, particularly Stephanie, to me, my thinking going into the fourth was, as long as she doesn't fuck this one up, and, you know, which was a little bit of a concern, right? Because in day one prep, this was not eating well. It was eating dry. The cookies weren't soaked. But I felt like if Melissa can just, as long as she doesn't flub the dessert, even if she's outmanned on this particular course, that she's got this.
Yeah. And again, like, she was so serene when Liam's like, oh, I don't know if this is eating kind of dry. It's not really got the right consistency. And she's like, yeah, tomorrow if we don't hit it and we need 4 hours before we serve, we'll just do it all. We'll do a redo. And I was just like, I would be freaking out. Like, what if I'm spending all this time working on the redo and my other dishes fall apart, you know? And she was able to put together that tiramisu that with the milk tea that was a blend between Chinese and Italian, where to the point where Dario Cecchini was just crying, sobbing at the table, Kevin. She made a butcher that I think is kind of like a gargoyle almost just turn into a puddle. It like this. This was, I know you said the third dish won the, like her main course won the competition for her. But if that was the go-ahead home run, this was the fucking grand slam.
Well, this was the exclamation mark. This is the one that put it out of reach.
God.
Right? And what I really loved about the dessert was it perfectly captured the identities of these three chefs in one final stroke, right? As you said, Melissa, it's the pure apotheosis of her Chinese-Italian idea, right? Hong Kong milk tea tiramisu. I mean, perfect. For Stephanie, she goes to an old classic comfortable standby, yeah. Right? Oh, and sticky toffee pudding with yogurt ice cream. I mean, God, I'm going to eat the shit out of that, right? Now, by the way, I thought it was interesting that one of the chefs kind of said, who doesn't love this? I think it was a little bit of a backhanded compliment, which is, you know,
who doesn't love donuts, cheap. Kevin?
You know? Yeah, it's a little cheap, right? Like, it's a little, like, of course, you know, we want to see some elevated cooking. And Voltaggio does a Voltaggio. You know, a malted chocolate mousse with that little kind of hard coating, a hazelnut ice cream, and a coffee cardamom soil. So yeah. You get that. I love that. That's to me, that like, is a Voltaggian stroke.
Kevin, if I presented those three dishes without telling you who made the dishes,
I didn't even know.
It would take half a second for you to say Melissa, Brian, and Stephanie, right?
Without question. And that was sort of the beauty of the final course. I don't know how you even scored them. I sort of have Melissa 1 because, again, the crying sort of gives you it. I have Voltaggio 2. Just because I think it did speak to the judges. It spoke to the ambition. Yeah. And Stephanie, a very close third, nothing to be ashamed of. But again, she fell back on an old comfort favorite, which, by the way, looked fantastic. And I got to tell you, I might enjoy eating that one more than any of the other two.
Let me ask you this, actually, though.
Milk toast tiramisu is my jam.
What if – would you have liked the dark chocolate to spill out and pour out of the dish? Or you'd rather be a little bit more like – thick consistency, because I actually kind of like when you crack open the chocolate ball egg, so to speak, and it just falls out. It just bleeds out. So I
know it's going to sound controversial. I know for effect I certainly like that, but then I have to eat it. And what am I licking it off with my tongue? Like, I want to get my spoon with something kind of yummy and gooey and put it on my tongue. Like, I don't – like, I appreciate the effect and the theater of crack this and
yep.
But, like, the truth is I don't want to eat that. Now I'm like sitting there tilting the plate into my spoon. It's like, no, give me mousse that I can get on my spoon. And also, I love malted. I love malted milk kind of mixed in stuff. I love that flavor. I've always loved Whoppers. I love a malt. I'm a big fan of that. So I was very into his dessert. Although I think Hong Kong tea tiramisu, I love those sweet milk teas that you get in like Hong Kong and Canton in that area. I love that stuff.
All right. So Kevin, judges table, let's talk about it. I felt like Melissa was going to win this thing. When Stephanie says, the best line of the night was from Stephanie when she says, I think I'm going to go for fan favorite.
Yeah.
It was just, she's a comedian. Like her... like when she delivers the cadence, all of that is just so perfect. And I think it was clear at that point. I think Brian probably knew it, and hopefully we'll get to talk to Brian about this. I mean, Melissa with the knockout punch of the tiramisu. And we got at the judges' table the emotional moment that Gail and Stephanie had. And I don't know. This was one of those seasons, and I'm so glad, Kevin, that they were able to do all three of the contestants be able to give the four courses, because of what happened last year with Eric Agyapong. We didn't get to see him with the full course. And I think, I believe it was Melissa in her original season didn't get to do that either. And so we got to see all three dishes. And I think it was important to get all of them because I didn't want to be shortchanged. And they go up there and Melissa won. And I knew that I was rooting for Stephanie from a personal standpoint and her, what she said at the judges table about how she wanted to tell people in her life who had felt that she was too sad or too down that she was able to go on the show and prove that she was okay and that she's okay. And I just was like, oh my God, there's so much there. There's so much there. The weight of the world on Stephanie just getting to the top 10, she said, was a huge accomplishment for her. And then getting there, and I think she put up a hell of a fight to get to go against Brian fucking Voltaggio and Melissa King, who just had probably the greatest season of Top Chef history. And Stephanie was right there.
Yeah, I mean, she is, again, a great, great story. Just obviously the personal arc, the fact that I don't think any of us had her in the finale as recently as 6 weeks ago and maybe even four. It's a fantastic story. She grew as a chef. She accomplished something personally she wanted to accomplish. You know, I feel, you know, Voltaggio is sort of because I don't know if it's the name because he's sort of a fixture. You know, I loved his character on the show. If that makes sense.
Sorry.
I mean, not just the weird, awkward dad laugh, but just look, I love his cooking. You know, he was sort of a, you know, coming in so close twice in a row, not twice in a row, two previous times, but you know, he had a nice arc too. He was sort of laying in the weeds. We talked about it for weeks. And it just really cooked his ass off. And I really loved it. But I mean, to me, Melissa, no regrets. I mean, my house was a Stephanie house, I think, because, you know, the underdog was claimed. But I mean, I just want to eat in Melissa's restaurant. I don't know if she'll do this Chinese-Italian fusion thing. She certainly could. I imagine she has other stuff she probably wants to do. It would be a great calling card, given that she kind of wrote it to a victory on the iconic Top Chef. But I cannot wait to eat in a Melissa King restaurant. Tom, I hope you and I will have the opportunity there, whether it's in an NBA final or just on another thing. I'm thrilled with the outcome of the season because I just, frankly, I love her food. I love her style. I love her brain. I love her poise. A fitting winner for a great season.
Kevin, I got to watch last night. I just decided to stay tuned for the Andy Cohen Watch What Happens, like interview with Colicchio and Padma. And that was after there was kind of an overtime. Did you happen to catch that?
I did not catch it.
All right. So they did kind of just like a postscript interview with Tom and Padma. And they also announced who the fan favorite was last night.
Oh, who won it?
Melissa King.
And Melissa is the double dip.
One of three chefs. I looked this up, Kevin. Melissa King not only won seven fucking elimination challenges and a handful of quickfires this season, she also won the fan favorite. And I think if they were taking the votes at just waiting until after this episode, maybe Stephanie wins it. But I think Melissa wins fan favorite, the third chef in Top Chef history. The first one was in season 4 with Stephanie Izard. Then season 16 last year, Kelsey won the fan favorite as well. So we had two double dips in the last 2 years. Melissa, I think people just fell in love with Melissa, just not just the cooking, but also how positive she was and how, I don't know, there was not an – it didn't feel like a shred of animosity or bad blood at all on Melissa's part. And I think the story arc of her father, her mother, who happened to be there, and it was weird that she was FaceTiming, like she was at home, but then she showed up for the last ceremony. Melissa won the fan favorite. And Tom Colicchio said that was probably the best meal he's ever had on Top Chef. That last final dinner with the four course meals from the three chefs, Season 17 was the best meal he's ever had on Top Chef. And you know what? I know there's a lot of recency bias here, but I think that's probably accurate.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to say. But it was a fun show. I mean, there was actual tension. I mean, I'm thinking halfway through, we have no idea. This could go to anywhere. I even talked myself into the Zapruder reinterpretation that, you know what, Brian Voltaggio, always a bridesmaid, never the bride. Maybe that's sort of you are Top Chef, like a kind of finally you did it or whatever. I even talked myself because I was like, he's going to be tough down the stretch. Like I knew that stew was going to be good and I knew his dessert would be good. Like it was nip and tuck. Tom, I hope that we will speak in 2 days or 3 days, in which point we will have all three finalists on Pack Your Knives, which is very exciting.
But before we go, Kevin.
Yes.
Why don't you just do a quick, we do this every year.
Oh, do we have to?
But not necessarily about what you did, your team versus my team. I mean, it was a rop. It was 233-131. Okay. Well, let's put that aside. We did a hell of a job drafting. I do this every year where I run the correlation of the points that these contestants accrue in our fantasy standings and then mark it against what the draft order was. And I think there's only one point when I think we really screwed up, which is Melissa went eighth, Kevin. Melissa went eighth. We got we got through seven different chefs before we picked Melissa. But here's how our draft went. And it's fun to kind of do a retrospective with the draft now that we've seen how things have played out. One, Gregory. Two, Kevin. Three, Nini. Four, Eric, Brian, Karen, Sasto, Melissa, Jen, Stephanie, Angelo, Leanne, Jamie, Malarkey, and Lisa. If you run the correlation coefficient, it comes out to 0.4 strength. One is perfectly 1-to-1 ratio. 0.4 is actually a moderate indication of correlation, and then zero would have been random, but we are at 0.4. That's pretty damn good, Kevin. Especially with how much talent is in this season. I do think it's helped this year that we had kind of a track record that we could look on these chefs. But I think we did a damn good job drafting this year. And, you know, even though it was a lopsided affair, I do want to say, Kevin, you need to accept every trade that I offer. Because I think I bungled.
Remind me, what was the one I screwed?
I think I might have offered Melissa for like...
No, did you offer Melissa?
I think I offered Melissa at one point. Yeah,
I think it was like Jen Carroll.
There was a few offers
for
Kevin.
Somebody. I don't think you offered Melissa, did you?
Listeners out there, please fact check me.
Okay,
I don't want to do revisionist history. I forget what the trade calls were, but I know there was a Jen Carroll and Malarkey. But I think the final question I want to ask you, Kevin, before we go and look forward to Monday's show: what if Gregory didn't get hurt?
It's a good question. It's a really good question.
What if Gregory didn't get hurt? Man, that is something that's going to hang over this season for a while. We'll never know. And I would love to hear what they think about that. Is like whether him going down with a back injury was kind of like you kind of turn the corner on the last leg of the Kentucky Derby and you see a horse just kind of fall back in the pack and you're like, you know what? I see daylight. This could be mine. I think that might have been the moment for all of them when they realized, oh, man, I think I can win this thing.
And he was hurting. I mean, he couldn't even make the sous chef episode.
Yeah.
That's rough. So best to Gregory as well. Disappointing we won't be able to talk to him on the finale episode. But this will be fun. Stay tuned. Pack Your Knives, listeners. We will have a finale special edition episode that will be dropped sometime early mid next week. Any closing thoughts, Tom?
This is a great season. It was a great season. I don't know if it was my favorite season of all time. But I thought it was a really strong season and seeing Stephanie there at the end was, I think, one of the coolest things that Top Chef has done is just the story arc there. So I was really, really pleased with how the season turned out.
For Tom Habistro, this is Kevin Arnovitz, and this is Pack Your Knives.